Welcome to Invisible Machines, a podcast produced in partnership with UX Magazine that explores AI agents and the ways conversational technologies are impacting our lives, our work, and the forces that drive us. I'm Josh Tyson, co-author of Age of Invisible Machines, a best-selling book all about the orchestration of AI agents, and I am joined each week by Rob Wilson, CEO and co-founder of OneReach.ai. Rob has been at the helm of enterprise AI solutions for decades, and this podcast is where we investigate bold ideas from our book and beyond with other AI insiders, as well as some of the most interesting people that we can find. In this episode, we are very happy to welcome back Blaise Agueda-Iarcas, author and Google's CTO of Technology and Society. Blaise joined us back in season 2 for a great conversation about identity and collective intelligence, spurred by 2 books he wrote for Hat and Beard Press, Who Are We Now?, and his debut novella, Ubi Sunt. His new work, What is Life?, is the first part of a larger book project with MIT Press and Antikythera titled What is Intelligence? Along with a limited edition of a pocket-sized edition in print, What is Life? Is also available to read for free online. Look for the direct link in the show notes for this episode. Blaise is joining us again to explore ideas from this new book, which draws fascinating parallels between the life-building chemical reactions taking place in natural chimneys deep in our oceans and pivotal work done by Alan Turing in the mid-20th century alongside mathematician John von Neumann. According to Blaise, self-reproduction and hence life is inherently computational. And rather than being something separate from us, technology is actually an extension of our very evolution. Blaise is a winner of MIT Technology Review's TR35 Prize and Fast Company's Most Creative People Award, and he's also a frequent TED speaker. He is a seriously captivating dude, so let's get right into this great conversation with Blaise Agueda-Iarcas. Invisible Machines is produced for UX Magazine in partnership with OneReach.ai. Named a leader by every major analyst group, OneReach.ai's Generative Studio X platform was built specifically to facilitate the no-code orchestration of AI agents. GSX is trusted by global giants like PepsiCo, PwC, Deloitte, and DHL, but anyone can experience the level of agent orchestration we talk about on this podcast through interactive demos at OneReach.ai. Now, on with the show. Well, Blaise, it's so great to have you back on the podcast. Rob and I have really been looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. Thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that occurred to me as I was reading through What is Life? Is that it is, as we were talking about before we got into this conversation, it's a pocket-sized book, but it contains a lot of big ideas, exciting ideas about life and technology. I thought maybe I'd read this line from the book, and then maybe you could describe sort of how you've come to view the origins of life in your research. So you mentioned that in an almost literal sense, our bodies are like Russian matryoshka dolls, membranes within membranes, and each nested environment recreates an earlier stage in the evolution of life on Earth. I love the way you phrase that, and I think it does a really good job of kind of setting the stage with the sort of like complexity you're talking about and how each of us and our environment in total are almost like a living history. Of life.
Totally. It's not an entirely novel idea that, you know, the Lynn Margulis in at least one of her books, maybe multiple of her books, has said similar things. You know, she's talked about people as being basically colonies of bacteria, which is true.
Yeah, we're a plate for bacteria. I've heard that one. Is this less eloquent than the way you put it?
Well, but she was not just talking about being a vessel for all the bacterial populations in our gut, for instance, which is true, but also that every one of our cells is powered by mitochondria, which are bacteria, right. And the outer right. cell, the arc, is an archaea, which is, you know, the other kind of most ancient lineage of single-celled life. So, you know, we're literally kind of composites of these much earlier life forms. So, the way I would explain briefly what I meant by that line is that conventional evolutionary theory only thinks, and when I say conventional evolutionary theory, I mean the neo-Darwinian synthesis. So Darwin plus, you know, our sort of mid-20th century understanding of DNA and how it works. That synthesis just says evolution is about random mutation and selection and natural selection. With that picture, there's no arrow of time. Things don't get more complex over time. They just move around. They optimize for whatever the current niche or the current environment is. And that's why you have people like Stephen Jay Gould in the 80s saying things like, you know, everything has been evolving for 4 billion years. There's no life form that is more sophisticated than any other one or more evolved than any other one. They've all been evolving for the same amount of time. So it doesn't make sense to talk about one life form as being more evolved than another. And I disagree with Gould. And the reason I disagree is that, you know, yes, part of evolution is just things kind of changing their genomes gradually and optimizing around. But the big steps in evolution are these transitions where things compose together, things that are already alive and already evolving, suddenly team up.
Self-organized, yeah.
They team up and they begin reproducing together. And the most dramatic example of that is endosymbiosis, when mitochondria, you know, go and start living inside archaea and become eukaryotes. But there are many of those, well, not many, but, you know, a dozen, two dozen of those, including the ones where animals become multicellular. And when one of those things happens, you know, the thing that gets created out of those symbionts is by definition more complex than the things that came together.
It's like the you know, the collection of, it's almost like fractals, right? It's the collection, right. The communities are getting more complicated.
Exactly.
They're getting bigger and they're getting, yeah, you could look at an infestation as evolution of the organism, right? It is more, infestation is more complex. If you look at three termites in a house and then you look at a million termites in a house, everything's more complicated because
right.
they're bumping into each other. Just to get from point A to point B is not a straight line. Like,
totally.
If you look at it through this lens of a community or collections of things, there's no doubt that when in history have there been such complex communities? If it happened, we don't know. There's no remnants of it. Like, somebody might say aliens landed here way back when, but at this moment, Earth is, from our perspective, has never been so complicated.
Right. And the reason I think we can say that with some confidence is that when you have a colony of termites, for instance, you still have all the complexity of the individual termites, which is huge. Like an individual termite is very complex and itself a multicellular organism. It's like a fractal, as you say, you know, the parts are made out of parts. But there's an emergent behavior of the colony of termites that is different from you know, the complexity of an individual termite, and it adds. In other words, you know, it's not like we've gotten rid of the complexity of the termites, but you have something extra now. Insects became eusocial. I don't remember now how long ago, but you know, it's been at least 80 million years, I think. And that was a major transition. You know, like, and it was a little bit like a weak version of multicellularity, and so in that sense, colony dwelling insects are more modern. And more complex and more evolved, if you like, than non-colony dwelling insects, even though they're both still around, just like there are still bacteria around and still archaea around.
Yeah, so if you think about these things, the anatomy of the single individual community as alive, a community is a life,
yes.
Not many lives. It's many lives, but it's a life, Matryoshka, right?
It's both.
And you go, something binds them together. There's something that connects them together. And this is where technology starts to play a role into the evolution of complexity, because technology binds larger groups of people. Like, it facilitates this. It goes beyond the limits of physicality. Now you can get 10 million termites in a house, where physically there's not enough space.
Right. But maybe in a server farm there is.
And interacting, yes, in a server farm. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, and there's another, there's a very literal aspect of the Matryoshka analogy as well, which is that, you know, the endosymbiosis story of mitochondria into bacteria mitochondria into archaea is especially interesting because as far as we understand, and, you know, we don't know everything about the earliest origins of life, but one guess that I like a lot and that I open the book with is that black smokers, these environments undersea where the Earth's tectonic plates are pulling apart, you have carbon dioxide smoke bubbling through, and there are these ionic gradients that are formed naturally. They're hydrogen gas and proton gradients that form naturally across these thin rock walls in this kind of sponge-like chimneys that form there. That environment is an environment where a lot of the chemical reactions that form the metabolic motor that we run on today could have arisen just through chemical interactions. And in a way, the conditions inside our mitochondria, you know, appear to be kind of recreating that environment. And so in that sense, as you peel, you know, if you peel away membranes or layers, you literally are looking, you know, into more and more ancient parts of us that, in that case, recreate the conditions of the Hadean era, of way back in the Earth's history. Even if you look at the ribosome, I don't mention this in the book, but there's been some beautiful work on ribosomes that shows that that the core, the very innermost parts of the ribosome, are the oldest, and so evolution has essentially added layers to its outsides, and it's become more complex over time. But when you look at in the inside, that's sort of the OG ribosome.
You talk about when you're talking about those chimneys undersea and like all these parts kind of recombinating in ways that become mutually beneficial, and then they become these more complex entities. And I thought it was really cool how it just naturally extended to technology as well. I think you talk about spear tips and how, you know, a spear tip had to exist before a spear could exist. And you also needed like sinew, and you needed to figure out like how to fit a spear tip into the end of a stick. All that kind of stuff. I think in our book, we use the analogy of like the printing press being sort of recombinating an olive press or like an olive press and better paper and ink. But it really feels different when you think about it as part of an ongoing process of life evolving. The technology, I mean, we've had lots of good conversations about this, I feel like, in the past too, that the technology isn't as separate from ourselves as we sort of like to pretend that it is.
I think that's right. I mean, in the beginning, a lot of people who worked on complex systems thought of technology as having some analogies with life and evolution. But, you know, as the analogies pile up, at some point, I think you have to just step back and ask yourself, are we really looking at the same elephant? You know, just like the trunk and the legs and so on. And that view of technology, by the way, is one that I think was really beautifully articulated by W. Brian Arthur in a book, The Nature of Technology, I think from 2012, and what it is and how it evolves. And he very much is advancing this idea of technology as being always a composite of previous technologies. You look at the printing press or something, you know, like,
printing existed before that,
right? You know, casting existed before that. All these things needed to come together. Or the light bulb would be a classic example. Like, you don't get a light bulb unless you know
how to... The candle, yeah.
Well, not just a candle. You need to know how to blow glass, how to make a vacuum, how to draw filaments of wire, how to create current. And once you have all of those things, the light bulb is inevitable, which is why it gets multiply invented like a dozen times within a few years of each other. But that also explains why it speeds up, because the more you invent, you know, everything that you invent can then become a potential building block for further things. So the library keeps growing.
It kind of brings up that, like, do we invent or do we discover, because it's inevitable?
Exactly.
Right? As we probably discover, we don't invent, because it's going to happen whether you did it. It's just who does it first, who brings it to the world. But it's going to happen. I always have that sense, that feeling, with, especially like with AI, where there's this sense that whoever created it can put it back in the box. And you're like, well, they didn't create it. They found it.
Right.
And once you find something, you can't unfind it.
I agree with that. Although I also think that, I mean, some people go from that observation to the idea of historical determinism of technology, and I don't think that's right either. There is a combination of discovering and inventing. And, you know, the inventing part, it sounds kind of trivial, but like if you take the light bulb as an example, it was inevitable the light bulb was going to happen, you know, in those few years. But do you screw them in clockwise or counterclockwise, or do they have prongs? You know, like are they long or are they bulbous? You know, all these choices, or like the writing, does writing go from right to left or left to right?
Yeah, there's all like those properties of this stuff that
that's right.
Yeah, the properties are invented, the thing itself is discovered. You're right.
Exactly.
There's an influence. Absolutely.
There is. And those contingencies really end up mattering.
In biology, you get to name the thing.
That's right.
That's it. That's the name. And that may have a total impact on how people perceive the thing for the rest of time, just because you gave it a really crappy name.
100%. And it might change what can be done with it later on.
You know,
and life did the same. I mean, when life decided that we were going to have right-handed sugars and not left-handed sugars,
right.
It could have been the other way. But that then determines a whole bunch of things down the line.
It's funny. You would think I'd be like into it, but it actually, the responsibility feels like a weight. I don't know that I want to have that. I don't know why. I don't think I want everyone blaming me for the way this light bulb screws on.
Well, I think it's good to have, it's good to have choices that matter. Better than the idea of everything being faded. I think shining extra light on the places where there are these contingencies and what their downstream effects might be, that is the important part of the responsibility of technology development.
Yeah. It's funny, I feel like my technology journey has gotten to the place where I only invent stuff because I can't stop myself anymore. I don't even know why I do it. I just can't stop. Like, I was up till 2 a.m. last night coding, and I'm like, why am I doing this? I can't stop.
Coding is moresome, for sure. You get instant gratification from it. It's like crap.
Especially now. Holy cow. Yeah. There's so many things to talk about. We've talked to so many people since our last chat, like so many super, super interesting folks, like the head of NASA.
Oh, Dan Golden.
Dan Golden. Three presidents, the longest running chief. We had a conversation about with the author of Dopamine Nation that's coming out, and all of these concepts that have just brought up so many ideas. Dopamine being like, I guess, the one I wanted to talk about, because as you talk about life, and you want to boil it down to some like raw elements, some like, you know, the sort of periodic table of life. This one molecule, dopamine, is super interesting to me. And there's two things I want to throw out, and you can go down either road or both roads. One was, I have, as she pointed out quite correctly, this optimist view that AI is going to help us create sustainable dopamine levels. It's going to help us sustain our dopamine levels. As she pointed out, that assumes you want to. She's like, let's assume it's going to be the next big addiction, bigger than anything else, because it can help you abuse dopamine, and that's what people want. Put that one over here. Let's hit that one up. What are your thoughts?
Well, so in the bigger What is Intelligence book, I do go into dopamine, although I'm sure not in anywhere close to the detail of this book, which I can't wait to read. I'm very interested to see what her take is. But there's a simple-minded story about dopamine, which kind of emerged in the 90s, that it's basically a temporal difference learning signal. And this came out of the work of Bartow and Sutton, who invented TD learning. And then the work of Wolfram Schultz and others, who found in their monkey experiments a dopamine signal that looked like it was implementing TD learning, a form of reinforcement learning, of temporal difference reinforcement learning in brains. It was a very kind of elegant synthesis. But But the story, you know, in the years since has gotten a lot more complex. Like dopamine is much, much more complicated than that cartoon suggests. You know, it encodes a variety of different kinds of signals depending on where in the brain, under what conditions. So I don't think that we can tell a really reductive story about, you know, dopamine means this or means that. I mean, if we were to try on cartoon, it would be something like anticipation. But and there are
good
reasons.
Kind of like dopamine's a piano. You can play lots of songs.
Yeah. It's a one-note piano, but you can still use that one note to do a lot of things.
Good point, right. Different rhythms, yep, you're right.
Yeah.
It's a rhythm, yeah.
So it's not simple. I resist, you know, the idea of saying, like, you know, dopamine is just about pleasure or just about wanting or just about or whatever. And I don't think it's that simple.
Yeah, the molecule's simple.
Yeah. Yeah, but not the uses to which it's been put.
Right, exactly, yeah.
Modeling and prediction are words that I use almost interchangeably. And the reason is that if you want to make a model of something, of some data, the easiest way to train an unsupervised model of any kind is with masking. In other words, you just say, I'm going to black out parts of it, and the model has to do its best to inpaint or to say what goes in the blank. Anybody who knows about unsupervised AI will recognize this as the pre-training task. That's how AI is pre-trained nowadays, which is the huge majority of the computational work in training AI models. Predicting is just the same. It's just the part of the stimulus, if you like, that is blacked out is the future. So you know, predicting is a form of modeling. If you've modeled something and it's a time series, then you've automatically learned to predict it. I think that brains are all about prediction, and the key thing to maybe add there is that they're not just predicting the outside world; they're predicting themselves as well. You know, we are actors in the world, and we are predicting not just our environment but our own actions and how our actions will affect the world, and also others, how others will then turn model us and how they will be affected by our actions in the world. So it's kind of a hall of mirrors effect where prediction in an environment with a lot of other predictors in it results in this kind of explosion of complexity.
Yeah. It's like active inference, right? We predict and then we test our prediction. And when correct, in a way that surprises us, we get dopamine. When incorrect, when our predictions are wrong, you know, cortisol or whatever penalty, right? Dopamine. Until we're done, till we're finished, and then
right.
And then hopefully if you're healthy, you reset, but and you go find the next high.
Well, again, I mean, you know, what dopamine actually signals more complex than just a prediction error. But to first order, I think that's not wrong. You know, we're trying to predict the future, predict ourselves into existence in the future. You know, even things like feelings of, you know, hunger or thirst or and so on. Those are all prediction errors as well. You know, that's basically trying to predict yourself into existence in the future means predicting a you that is still alive.
Like, as I was reading your book, I was struck by like this idea that as humans, like in order to understand these complex things, we really often need to assign a timeline to them.
Mm-hmm.
And our perception of time is probably both helpful and problematic, but I guess I hadn't really thought until just now about how much of that is tied into the predictive nature of our brain, of that blank future state that we don't know about. Like, that is that kind of what drives this whole like timeline in our head? Because your book also does a really elegant job of kind of portraying it as this just like stew that's just always sitting there, and you can pick your place in it, but it's all kind of happening at once in a way too.
Totally. Yeah. I think that there's been a big debate in AI land about causality and about whether AI models, for instance, that are just pre-trained on text can have any sense of causality. Is it just correlation? And I guess my perspective on this is that if you're learning in an environment that includes time, that involves time sequences and masking out things in time sequences, then that learning does involve learning about causes. What we think of as causes are regularities about likelihoods of things following each other in time. And it can be kind of inefficient to learn about causality that way. It can be much more efficient to say try an experiment and see if things work out, as your model would have predicted. As active agents, of course, we do that all the time. There's a lot of experimentation, but it's not impossible to learn those things just from passive observation either. It just takes more work and more data. If we couldn't learn about causal relationships by just observing, then there would be no such thing as astronomy, for instance, right? Because obviously you can't do active interventions, out there in the cosmos. We're just looking at photons ultimately.
Yeah. You have to be wrong as much as you're right to manage dopamine levels. Your predictions, you have to start predicting things that you're not sure are going to be right. And you don't want to predict things that 90% of the time are going to be wrong, or you'll be depressed.
Right.
50-50. And that's what's funny, because then you take that and conversation and we walk over to a conversation with the head of NASA, who says he only hired engineers and his rule was 50-50. They had to have a 50-50 chance of succeeding at whatever. That anybody who had a 90% chance, he fired them. Anybody with a 10% chance, dreamer, fired them. They had to have a 50-50 chance of success, which meant they knew what they wanted to do and they had a vision for it. And it's just funny how one conversation is super cerebral and neuroscience-y, and the other one is just a guy trying to get to the moon, or actually in his case, it was build the International Space Station. But you can just see how these things too connect, that it's not just the way you get to the moon, but it's the way you live a happy life.
Yeah.
That's me preaching. I have a question though, I promise, and that is the meaning of life for this bigger being.
Mm-hmm.
Not meaning of life for the individual in it. What is the meaning of life for the larger organism?
Can I
meaning of life
to your,
for life itself?
you mean for Gaia, for the entire planet, I assume.
Yes. Or whatever it is, it's Matryoshka, the collective, not the individual. Yeah.
Well, in some sense, there's only one game in life, which is to keep playing. And this is a I take a little bit of a stand against the idea of money or utility or scalar values in the last part of what is intelligence. So part of the reason I take a stand against utility is because the idea that that life is somehow playing a game that it gets to win on points is just not right. Real life is always interdependent with other life, and there's always a give and a take, if you like. You give things, you get things. They're incommensurable. And the way that you quote unquote win at that game is that you're still around to play it tomorrow. Now, the dynamics of keeping on playing it tomorrow also means that game becomes more complex and more beautiful over time, because things can start to cooperate, combine, join forces, make something larger than themselves, and then you have this bigger, more complex, and perhaps more powerful predictor that arises out of that. So there's an inherent complexifying dynamics to that. But the game is always to keep playing.
And how does time fit into that? Where's time in that story?
Well, there's a classical view of time where that comes out of Boltzmann and the second law of thermodynamics from the 19th century, which holds that time is the process of things becoming more and more disorderly. Everything devolves into
entropy, right?
Entropy, heat death. And in classical physics, that's actually the only sense of time that we've got. Entropy is the only thing that gives time an arrow, and that arrow is toward disorder. But in this symbiotic view, there is an opposite arrow of time, which is the one whereby things become more beautiful and more complex over time. It's in a way the very opposite, even though the two are compatible with each other.
So the faster they evolve means the faster they get complex.
Yes.
Or is it the faster they fit into their environment and adapt?
Well, I mean, you mentioned, the stone point and the spear. So there's an ordering in time there, because you obviously can't have a hafted spear before you have a stone point and a sinew and a wooden stick. Those three things have to come together to make the spear. So there's an inequality there. These things occur first, these things occur second. So if you like, I think of time as being like a tree that involves all these mergers, and when multiple things have to merge into one thing, that tells you that things that had to merge came before, and the things they merge into comes after.
So we've created, it seems, in the world like this sort of fractured ecosystem of advanced technology that's now on the verge of, you know, with conversational technologies, all these other technologies are on the verge of being able to communicate with one another, like software talking to software. Are we kind of on the verge of a moment where, like the beginning of your book explores the origins of life, and we're stretching that across, you know, millions, billions of years. So it becomes hard to kind of wrap your head around, but now we're maybe in a moment where all of this stuff, and it feels like it's going to be similar actions, right? Like a lot of combining, and things coming together to become more complex entities. Might that happen at such an accelerated pace that we almost get like a condensed view of the origins of life, or are they separate in a way that doesn't really make that compatible?
Well, I mean, I do think that you know, as I said, history on Earth is a matter of these mergers. And in fact, you could even go before Earth and think about, you know, molecules as being a merger of atoms, you know, atoms as being a merger of subatomic particles and so on. So things have been merging for as long as we've had a universe, you know, into more and more complex things that persist through time and can then interact with each other to combine, form further things that can persist through time. So there is an inherent speeding up dynamics behind that. You know, and this sounds a little bit like, you know, Kurzweil's singularity. I'm not a singularitarian, so I you know, there are a lot of things about that perspective that I don't agree with. But
unless it's a community, unless it's a word to describe a lot of independent things.
It is a word. It is an umbrella term that describes a lot of independent things. I guess the reason that I tend to distance myself from it is because it's closely associated with utilitarianism.
Yeah, it suggests single, which is human, anthropomorphic, and there's no reason.
There are a bunch of issues, exactly. I think that Ray, you know, is also right about a bunch of things, including a bunch of things that he was, you know, was not necessarily given credit for, you know, for calling out that acceleration and being quite accurate in forecasting it. I think that's correct. And Brian Arthur, you know, who did this kind of How Technology Evolves business, described exactly why things speed up as well, which is that, you know, when stuff combines, you have more parts on the table, and therefore the amount of time that it takes to pick up a couple of parts and combine them to make something new shrinks. And he's, you know, he and his colleagues have done quantitative models of that also, you know, they give you this exponential increase. So yes, things are moving faster and faster, without question.
So then, if I got this right, the thought process here is fighting entropy, right? Things that organize, right? That's life. And as we look at singularity as a concept, it's just an interesting lens to look at how we see the world, right? Not that how the world is. You could just look at singularity as humans organizing in a larger group, like a larger swarm, right?
Yeah, that's right.
Things communicating and independently bumping into each other, and like there's no single mind, there's nothing singular about it other than the fact that it's a larger group,
right?
Than we've ever had before.
It's like
larger
runs on
than
a
any
ladder.
Collective we've ever seen.
Exactly. It's like rungs on a ladder or steps on a staircase. And it's not our first rodeo either. So, you know, the Industrial Revolution, the first Industrial Revolution, when we started to harness fossil fuels to power steam engines, that was a major transition like that as well. You could think of it as a symbiosis between machines and people.
It's a bunch of people building chairs to a factory of people all together building chairs.
Right. Yeah. And one of the effects that had is that it allowed, by people coming together and building steam engines, and then steam engines being able to liberate energy from coal, and then that being able to, you know, to power, tractors and pumps and all kinds of other devices, the human population began to explode. In the Industrial Revolution. So it's a feedback loop where a lot more humans can exist with steam power than could exist before steam power. So humans build the machines, but the machines also build more humans.
Yeah.
It's a symbiosis.
That is so fascinating. This idea that technology brings people together in clusters, even it's such a fascinating way to look at it and to say, that's what's happened. Why won't it? That be what will happen. That's so it facilitates the coagulation of humans in larger groups and coordinates them, which to you that's life, right?
Yeah. And those larger structures that emerge from that are also alive in some way.
So the better our tech gets, the larger and the more coordinated and connected we become. In some weird way, even though throughout that there's ups and downs,
Throughout, I mean, it's not that this means that it's all smooth and there are no disruptions. I mean, obviously,
right.
This is a story full of drama and disruptions of all kinds.
People still get their arms caught in the
machine,
absolutely. A loom, an electric loom. Yeah,
yeah, and there's still these massive displacements. The story of the Luddites is very informative in this way. And I'm sure we'll have disruptions of that sort as well this time around. I don't think you can have evolution without disruption.
Well, it seems possible too that, I guess to simplify a little bit, like the merger of technology and humans that's kind of on the horizon, we talked with James Bridle, who wrote Ways of Being, and they mentioned, they brought up the point that like the idea of the environment is sort of a fallacy.
Is wrong. I agree totally with James.
Because it creates like a separateness that really doesn't exist between the individual and the environment. It's all the environment.
I've read James's book as well, and I agree with the points they make. I think that the idea of an externality or an environment as providing ecosystem services or whatever for people is just nonsense. We are mutually interdependent with all of the other beings that we think of as our environment. Almost everything is alive. And there are all of these loops and cycles whereby the inputs of one thing are the outputs to another. This kind of Cartesian wound or this idea of us as being somehow separate from nature, I think is a flip side of the idea of us as being separate from technology. This is also a thing that I think James and I agree with, that, in a way, our romanticism, our romanticized idea of ourselves as not technological is just the other side of the coin from the idea of ourselves as being not natural.
Yeah. And like all this, like the trajectory of technology right now, I guess, especially maybe to people who aren't inside of it, it feels like it's running into this like unknown future, but it's also in a way sort of closing a circle, I suppose.
Yeah. I mean, the future has always been unknown. It's just a question of on what time scale.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, so the last conversation we had, we ended up in this same place, that AI is going to bring people together.
I don't want to be too Pollyanna about it, I do think that it allows us to make larger and smarter structures.
Yeah, with lots of bumps along the way. Right. What do you think of fear that it's going to be the next ginormous addiction?
Oh yeah, that Dr. Anna Lemke.
Anna's
the author of Dopamine Nation. Yeah.
What do I think about her fear about this essentially enabling us to become addicted in unprecedented ways to our technology? Do you mean?
Yeah, I mean, she liked the idea of it.
Facilitating our addictions, not being addicted to it.
Yeah.
But it facilitating our addictions to everything. Yeah.
Yeah, that you might have your own sort of personal AI agent that instead of like letting you be manipulated by all the algorithms foisted on you by corporations, maybe it would be designed to sort of protect you from them and actually limit your exposure to technology,
yeah.
Which seems really reasonable, which also makes it seem unlikely in a way.
I mean, I think that there's a real risk in that kind of discourse of falling into moral panics. This is definitely a rodeo we've seen before, right? Where a new technology or a new capability, unlocks something that allows us free access to something that was very difficult before, or brings us just far outside of what we think of as our quote unquote natural evolutionary niche. I mean, the fact that it's trivial to eat nowadays, you know, that I can just go on Caviar or go down to the corner and buy a sugary anything. These are very different circumstances from the kind of, the Malthusian want that we've lived in for the last 10,000 years. You know, does that mean that everybody turns into, the Wall-E people, the people in Wall-E, the Pixar movie, which is a beautiful movie, by the way, right? It's not like that concern is misplaced. There are famous, we've all become more obese, in the era of free calories, most of us, I certainly have, and less healthy in a bunch of ways. There's a bit of a processed food crisis probably, in the US, in Polynesian countries where people's metabolisms are especially well adapted to sort of suck all the fat and calories out of things. The introduction of processed foods was especially devastating in those places. So, it's not like I think those concerns are silly or are wrong, but, it's always only the first half of the story. Like, there also are, new approaches to living, new lifestyles, new ethoses, et cetera, that arise out of all of that. And that's why, it used to be the case that being overweight was a sign of being wealthy, and now it's started to become the opposite. Right. So I expect that we'll see a lot of those cycles and counter cycles with respect to all these new things that are being unlocked today through these new symbioses between people and technology. I don't think it's going to be a simple story. So I don't want to dismiss her concerns, but I also think that the story is bigger than any single one of those concerns, if that makes sense.
And I think she would agree. It was more of an exploratory. She has this concept of radical honesty, and I love it. Like, if it doesn't hurt to say it, it's not honest enough.
Yeah.
And she's, from my experience, practices it, which is refreshing.
Yeah, that's great.
But we kind of adapted that to AI, like as a cultural thing, not as a law that should be passed, but that as a designer, designing the interactions with machines, that radical honesty would be a good practice, an ethical practice for the machine to be radically honest, not just the person.
Unfortunately, that's not how we have been fine tuning them on the whole. My experience. So I've become a pretty big user of AI models of all of the big ones. I use all of them nowadays.
Yeah, me too.
But they're so obsequious today. I asked Gemini something, just before we went on the podcast, and it was like, it's great that you point that out, that's a really good question. And it's like, no, that was not a good question. Actually, that was a really stupid question.
Yes.
But it will never tell you that was a really stupid question. Like, go back and think. I think that it's, in a way, our insecurities, our standing as humans has deeply informed the way we've tended to fine tune these things. And I actually see that as a problem.
Yeah, we had the thought too that that a radically honest AI might do some of that necessary or perhaps necessary work of de-anthropomorphizing AI so that it seems less human to us. Like if something's radically honest, it's probably going to be a little bit off-putting. It might kind of hurt your feelings. And so it might change the way you bond with it, I guess, on an emotional level.
Well, I have a little bit of a different perspective on that. My feeling is so. First of all, you know, it's not like AI models have a inherently non-human way of being that would be their honest selves. I mean, you know, the fact is they're trained today on tons and tons of human discourse. So human discourse is what they do. You know, that is native. I mean, there's a whole span, of course, of human discourse from the extremely toadyish to the, you know, super aggressive, you know, and direct or honest, you know, right? All of that is in the gamut, but it's the human gamut. That is what it is. Our ability to cooperate with each other is based on mutual understanding and even empathy. So, you know, without even getting into the question of whether AIs have, you know, truly have subjective experiences or truly feel things, I'm not even sure that question, you know, is rigorously answerable or means anything. But I do know that that being able to model others in a caring way is part of the machinery of how we do cooperation, how we come together. So if cooperation is going to happen,
that's an interesting point.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of pro anthropomorphism in that sense. I think
if we welcome them into our group and we're saying they, then we, we need the tools of connectivity.
That's right.
Yeah.
And you know, the way James Bridle would put it is, you know, this is really about acknowledging that what we think of as the human is already the more than human. You know, that a lot of those behaviors that we think of as being anthropomorphic, you know, what is small-minded about us is just thinking about that as anthropomorphic. You know, it's actually already more than that.
Yeah, agreed. That's an interesting perspective, that the survival of the group is based on adaptation. Adaptation is accelerated through technology because it speeds up our ability to adapt as a larger group, not as an individual organism, but as a larger group.
Right. And our ability to model others, to have theory of mind about others, is kind of the glue that makes that work.
Right. And the degree of our connectivity is literally the fuel of our success. Our, you know, if you think of it competitively, which I don't think is necessary, but if you think of it competitively, that's the strength of the connectivity is what accelerates. It's the coordination, right?
Exactly.
You know, being in unison.
Joseph Henrich literally called that the secret of our success. That's the title of his book about this phenomenon. You know, we are asking for AI models to think about and model us. That's obviously super important. I mean, any you know, when we talk about alignment, that's really what we mean, right? You know, don't just follow instructions blindly. Like, think about what, you know, what we're feeling, what we want, you know, et cetera. So we need them to model us. But, you know, what I found really, really interesting is that in his book, Co-Intelligence, Ethan Mollick, you know, is just giving some very workaday advice about how to work effectively with AI models, is actually saying, by the way, you need to model them as well. You know, don't just think about it as a search engine or whatever. Think about it like a smart, but sometimes a
100%.
Loopy intern, you know, and like, right, think about things from the AI's point of view. And obviously the collaboration will be much more successful.
It's funny how this anthropomorphic concept is such a superposition. Like every second you see the bad and the good, and there just is no answer on this one.
Yeah.
And I don't think there ever will be. I think this will just be something we argue forever.
I agree with you. I think that things like personhood are really about relationships. And if you center relationships rather than centering the nodes in the graph, then you realize that there can't be an answer, because relationships are all about interactions.
Yeah. It's always going to be, should you model the interaction with the machine after humans? It depends.
Yeah.
It's just always going to be the answer.
Yeah, that's right.
It really depends. Yeah, it becomes the art, I guess, of this whole, you know, experience design, if we want to call it that. Although that suggests some degree of power. You can design that book.
That's right.
But when that book can design itself, it becomes more interesting.
It does. But then again, nothing really quite designs itself. You know, it's interactions all the way down. And You know, so we also tend to lump together all humans and say we, you know, as if we have some unified agency. It's not really like that.
I know. I was thinking about that, and just on this call, like, I almost want to count the number of times the average person says I versus we to see which one they use more. I was like, I think we, you know,
we are social animals.
Yeah. If we say we more, then I guess we're more of a we than we are an I.
Yeah. I think we are very much more a we than an I. Individuals are not all that capable on their own, at least not modern urbanized individuals. And we're becoming less capable on our own every year, but more capable collectively.
It really does make more sense logically to think in those terms. I mean, it really does move things, you know, to think and not to be like be mathematical about it, you know. Forget just right and wrong. It just makes more sense mechanically if people are coordinated. This is a great
Agreed.
Chat, just like last time.
Yeah, I feel like we answered as many questions as will be posed as usual. So,
but we've covered a lot of ground, and wonderful yeah. Questions and provocations.
Yeah, I can't wait to read the book. It's just so thought provoking. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, congratulations on the book, and thanks for sharing this this first portion in such detail with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I'm really glad that you guys enjoyed it, and I hope others do as well. Yeah. It was lots of fun to write.
All right. Well, thanks for hanging out with us again here on Invisible Machines. Don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Always remember that you can watch this podcast, too, on our Invisible Machines YouTube channel. Head over to uxmag.com. We have a podcast page there where you can explore our back catalog, and you can look at episodes centered around popular topics. Many, many thanks to our incredible production team here in the U.S. and in Ukraine, Elias Parker, Michael Litvinov, Allison Harshberger, Alla Slesarenko, Vera Pokodkov, and Darina Moskovchuk. Till next week. Owagi.